How did you get interested in writing a history of riches to begin with?
Actually, I wasn't that interested in writing a history on riches to begin with. What had happened was, as I do tours for the Atlanta Preservation Center, and as a result of that, I got interested in writing articles on Wikipedia for historical buildings in Atlanta. And as a result of that, on the back end of Wikipedia, you can go through that and contact the writers of the articles. And the publisher, actually, History Press, contacted me that way and actually came into my spam folder. I'm actually surprised they even checked it. And I decided to look at it, and they asked me if I was interested in doing a history on riches. And at first, I was like, well, maybe. But then I wrote a 12-page outline for a different book that I wanted to do, and then slapped together very quickly a page and a half outline on riches, sent that to them, and they said, that's good. We want you to do the riches book if you'll do it. So I got involved, and
the rest is history.
And the rest is history, yeah. Okay.
Morris Rich's story, in one way, comes across as the typical American success story. Young Jewish immigrant from Hungary, makes his way to Atlanta after the Civil War, borrows money, starts a business, and succeeds beyond his wildest dreams.
Right.
It really is quite a story,
right.
Isn't it?
It really is a story. It's an amazing story. And there's even a connection to Macy's, which I didn't put in the book, which is interesting. Isidore Strauss is from Talbotton, Georgia, but he was a Hungarian Jewish immigrant as well. Before the Civil War, he had immigrated to Talbotton and opened up a dry goods store there. More than likely after the Civil War, when Morris came into Georgia, he was working in that area horseback at the time. So they probably knew each other and knew of each other. Well, after the Civil War, Morris decided to settle in Atlanta. Isidore Strauss decided to go north. So he went to New York, opened up a pottery-type shop in the basement of R.H. Macy. After a couple of years, bought R.H. Macy from the Macy's family and then made Macy's what it is today. And interesting enough, he died on the Titanic. So if anybody's seen the movie a couple of years ago with Leonardo DiCaprio, the old couple on the bed holding each other as the waves crash in is a throwback to Isidore and his wife, Strauss. And I was going to actually conclude the book that way, but decided that would tilt it more towards Macy's and not keep the focus on riches.
Well, there's a fine line between iconic American entrepreneur and what some of the South at the time might have labeled a carpetbagger.
I mean,
here's a guy who comes south, sees an opportunity following the Civil War. So.
Very much so. Very much so. I think what may have helped him is that his brother William was already here and had already established a couple of businesses in Atlanta. So I think there was a fine line. Yes, I agree with you. He could have been perceived as a carpetbagger, and especially during that time of Reconstruction when not too many people were happy with Northern business interests coming into the South.
So the first store on Whitehall Street, what did they sell?
You know, it was a hodgepodge of things. It was a small store at the time. What would become department stores basically catered toward female clientele. So it was hosiery, corsets, things of that nature. But it was a hodgepodge of different things, dry goods and we don't use that term anymore today, but dry goods basically meant anything but hardware or groceries. So it was a little bit of everything, knickknacks, bric-a-brac for the house, linens, things of that nature.
And it was many years until Rich's seriously started focusing on men's clothing.
Yes. It was quite a few years. They had always carried a few items of men's clothing. But as I wrote in the book, it wasn't really until the store for men was established in 1951 that they really sort of started to focus on catering to men. And that particular store at the complex was amazing. I mean, it had a gun testing range, a private grill just for men until 2:30 p.m., at which point they would allow women to join them. It's quite hard to think of that in this day and age, but at the time it was an interesting concept. Unfortunately, it didn't do as well as they thought it would do, and they turned back to catering towards the female clientele, which is their bread and butter.
It seems they were always trying to be on the front line of innovation, always creating the newest, like they were setting the standard for fashion and trends in Atlanta. But they looked to the northern department stores in the Northeast, in New York and Boston, for their inspiration largely, didn't they?
Very much so. All the department stores, they all knew each other. All the families of all the stores across the country knew each other. Many of the people that eventually came to Rich's to work were from other department stores across the country. So they were very much in contact with each other, and they specifically were looking at each other to see what they were doing. What are they doing in New York? What are they doing in Portland? What are they doing in Chicago? And, the Pink Pig's a perfect example. So many people in Atlanta And the story's not been accurate until this came out. You know, everybody thought it was 1953, but with the Pink Pig, everybody thought it was just Atlanta that had this monorail, which was quite impressive. But when you start doing the research, they sold tons of these, dozens of them across the country to department stores in Chicago, Portland again, New York. It's very interesting. But yes, they always had their pulse on what was going on.
The concept of a department store is something that we're very familiar with now and have been
right.
for decades, but department store really is an early 20th century innovation, isn't it?
It is. It is. It was 1901, which Rich's became a department store. And Morris Rich, before he opened his store in 1867, you had, which I chronicled, they sold door-to-door, then you could sell via horseback. And if you were lucky enough, you hitched a wagon to the back of your horse and you were in the carriage trade. That term sort of carried over to these early stores before they became department stores, where they catered towards the carriage trade, which was considered the upper-class clientele. But department stores, it was a new concept. And actually, when Morris turned Rich's over into a department store format, a lot of his customers were not happy. They were used to coming in and having the same person wait on them from basically the front door through every single department. And they gave Morris a lot of grief, saying, we don't want to talk to people that are stationed in separate departments. And eventually he won them over, and eventually it was a concept that worked, and especially as Rich's grew. I mean, you know, by the time the store was torn down, the complex was 1.5 million square feet of space, which is the size of the Bank of America Tower on North and Peachtree. So you can imagine if they hadn't have done the department store, one person walking around to every department, it would be impractical and probably exhaust them quite a bit.
In the early history of Rich's store, it's amazing to me how many times Rich's renovated, remodeled, or moved a dozen times or more. I mean, it's amazing. And maybe a half dozen times on Whitehall Street alone.
Yes, yes. They were constantly moving, constantly looking for, you know, more space. And I think with the department store, or not at that time, but the retail store that they were, you know, they had to keep up. They had to keep up with the latest trends. And they didn't want to become stagnant. They wanted to constantly present a fresh face for people, a new facade, and lure people in. And, you know, I sort of allude to this at the end of the book, but department stores up until at least the mid-century, until you had White Flight, they were the Disney-esque temples of retail. I mean, that's where people went for their culture, in a sense. You had fashion shows, you had lunch, you determined all your fashions, what you should wear. You know, this is pre-television, pre-internet. So they were sort of the area where you went, the space that you went in the city to see what was going on in the world.
The golden age of retail in
yes.
Atlanta was, I guess, in the 20s when the term they used for the latest Rich's department store was the Palace.
Yes.
Down on Broad in Alabama.
Right.
What was that like?
It was quite a spectacle. I mean, you know, at the time it was 180,000 square feet when they opened it, which was and is quite large. It, of course, grew much larger than that. But they called it the Palace of Commerce. And, you know, it was this grand Italian Renaissance building with, you know, rustication at the bottom and swags and this ornate clock and a cartouche. And it was, you know, to represent the Italian Renaissance was quite popular, or the Italian Renaissance-type architecture was on purpose by architects to harken back to the merchant princes of Italy that had changed Italy at that time. So it was an impressive store that grew up in that area, and it dwarfed the store that they previously had.
The store at Broad in Alabama, mm-hmm. the Palace, offered services and amenities far beyond the retail shopping experience. A free nursery for shoppers.
Yes.
A library.
Yes.
Right? Restaurants, including the Tea Room. And then there was Penelope Penn. Now, some of our listeners will remember Penelope Penn, but for those who don't, who was she?
Penelope Penn was actually a group of people. It originally started off, it was one woman, a Mrs. Harrington, and she started off in 1924 in New York. They opened Saks on Fifth Avenue, and they thought it would be a good idea to hire a Blue Blood Society matron to come in and sort of bring in her higher clientele. Because at the time, wealthy people would shop at department stores, but they tended to shop at more private, exclusive stores. So it was smart on their part to bring this woman in. So Rich's, and we don't know if Rich's decided first or Mrs. Harrington, who was a socialite here in Atlanta, decided to copy that success. But they started this Penelope Penn department in 1925, and she was at first going to just give people, you know, point them around the store, show them where they could buy certain merchandise. And it very quickly grew into much more than that. You know, they would call the fire department if a truck needed to be dispatched somewhere. They would purchase tickets for you for steamship travel, or they would book your hotel. They would get you a taxi. They would, of course, buy you a present. I mean, and have it sent anywhere in the country. One of their greatest services was that they had a file in their office. And what they would do is they would keep the birth dates and anniversary dates of Rich's customers on file. And at the time or near that anniversary, they would call that customer and remind them, hey, you have an anniversary coming up, or hey, you have a birthday coming up. And if it was a housewife in Buckhead by chance, they would call and say, your anniversary's tomorrow, in case you've forgotten. Is there a gift that you would like to get? And the housewife might say, well, could you suggest something? Penelope Penn would suggest a gift. And not only that, they would then purchase the gift, charge it to the customer's account, have it wrapped, and hand deliver it to the husband who might be working downtown Atlanta.
The ultimate concierge service.
Yes, yes. It was amazing. And the library was amazing, too.
So Rich's goes public.
Yes.
In 1929.
Correct.
Right before the stock market crashes.
Yes.
Timing is everything.
It is.
So now they're Rich's Incorporated.
Right.
They survived the Depression, though.
Quite well, actually.
Yeah. And becoming stronger as a result. And what's interesting is with cash short, the city of Atlanta is issuing scrip, IOUs, or Rich's starts accepting the IOUs from the city of Atlanta in lieu of cash.
Yes. The city starts issuing scrip because they don't have any cash, real greenback in the bank to pay their teachers. So they said, you know what, we'll give you this scrip. We'll allow you to use this throughout the city. Hopefully merchants will accept it. And when we get paid or we get cash reserves, we will then pay you with that cash. As was the case, and this wasn't just Atlanta, this was across the country that this happened. But with those people here in Atlanta, what happened was merchants didn't want to accept the scrip. You know, they thought, this is a worthless piece of paper. It's not going to be worth anything, so why would we give you merchandise on this, that which you may not ever get real money to pay us with real money? If the merchants did decide to accept the scrip, they would often charge a markup. If there was change to be given from that scrip, they would give store credit, not cash. So Rich's noticed this was going on in the city and decided and told the city that, you know what, we'll accept the scrip as cash. We'll even cash it, and the customers don't have to buy anything in our store. They can just come in and cash it. They actually set up 5 booths on their upper floors in order to accept this cash. And this was right at Christmas, the first couple months of December. So you had all these school teachers who weren't able to pay rent, weren't able to get groceries. Because of Rich's accepting this scrip as basically cash and becoming a bank in a sense, they could pay their rent. They could pay their bills or whatever they had. And it endeared those customers to Rich's. And, of course, it played out quite well for Rich's. It earned them loyalty. It became lore for generations of what Rich's did. And the customers went back. You know, they were like, well, look what Rich's did for us. We're going to go back to Rich's. So it was a wonderful PR opportunity, and it was a great service for the city. And, you know, what's been lost this history is that it didn't happen just one time. It happened at least 6 or 7 times over a decade throughout the entire 1930s.
The Magnolia Room.
Yes.
By that name, dates back to, 1941. It's a restaurant.
Right.
Segregated, of course, inside the store. Gone with the Wind premieres in Atlanta in December of 39.
Correct.
About 2 years later, the Magnolia Room opens up. Describe the Magnolia Room.
Magnolia Room was interesting. Rich's had always had a tea room since the 1924 store opened. Actually, that was one of the reasons why, when they were on Whitehall Street, one of their competitors opened up a tea room and sort of put Rich's in second place, because customers were like, wow, they have this great restaurant. So Rich's opened one in 1924, but it was just called the Tea Room. It was quite a wonderful thing. In the end of 1941, they started remodeling the Tea Room to coincide with their 50th anniversary, or their Jubilee celebration, and not 50th, sorry, 75th anniversary. And in order to do that, you're right, Gone with the Wind came out in 39, Margaret Mitchell's novel came out in 36, so you're leading up to a good 7 years, 8 years, where you have this re-romanticized view of the South and the Civil War and those types of things. And so Rich has capitalized on it. So at the end of 41, they remodeled. In January of 42, with their 75th anniversary, they opened the Magnolia Room, and it was an impressive restaurant. You know, you had huge white columns when you got off the elevator to go into the restaurant on the 6th floor, and they redid it with their colors of mimosa and all these exquisite colors. They put fake windows and a fake fireplace in it to recreate the ambiance. Of course, looking back at it now, we view it from differently, because they had their black or African-American waitresses dress up in Mamie-style dresses with their hair done up in bandanas, which we look at now as kind of quite garish. But they quoted in the paper at the time, you know, let us take you back to the nostalgic South, basically.
Fast forward to 1960.
Yes.
That Magnolia Room stands out as a pretty obvious symbol of old-time segregation.
Yes.
And it becomes a target of the Atlanta sit-in movement.
It does.
That goes on for quite a while during the year of 1960. Mm-hmm. It's ultimately successful in that the sit-in movement forces Rich's to desegregate the restaurant. Mm-hmm. But Dick Rich, who was the head of the company at that time, he fought it tooth and nail, didn't he?
He did. I think all the merchants fought it tooth and nail at the time. Dick Rich definitely didn't want to desegregate. He was afraid that he would lose his white clientele. What's amazing and what I didn't talk about in the book, though, is that Rich's had always been supportive of African-American causes. And actually in 1949, they had put a full-page ad in the Atlanta Constitution about being supportive of African-American colleges and the education of blacks in this country, and got all kind of hate mail, actually, from it. People took that ad and wrote, you know, horrible things on the ad and sent it into Rich's. So it's quite interesting that that preceded 11 years before the sit-in movement. But I think Dick Rich was doing what many patrons were doing. It was a volatile time, but it was an interesting aspect of history. And quite honestly, you could say that JFK became president, John F. Kennedy became president of the United States because of the things that happened at Rich's.
Martin Luther King Jr. was arrested.
Correct.
And imprisoned because of that sit-in.
Right. And it was his first night in jail ever.
And focused all sorts of attention on...
All kind of attention. It was brilliantly planned by Lonnie King, who was led the student movement out of the Atlanta University Center. It was brilliant. You know, they planned it just a few weeks before the 1960 election. They wanted to force Nixon and John F. Kennedy to make a comment. Neither one wanted to. Nixon may have won the election had he actually commented and addressed the issue. He just chose not to. Actually, John F. Kennedy's campaign got involved indirectly through Mayor Hartsfield at the time, who sort of basically lied and concocted a lie and said that JFK wanted him to work at making a solution and desegregating the city with black leaders at the time, which wasn't the case. You had Harris Wolford, who worked on Kennedy's campaign, had just expressed to Hartsfield that he would like the city to be able to desegregate peacefully. And of course, this brings in JFK's campaign and sort of forces their hand in the whole deal. And I chronicle in the book, there's quite a few characters and people involved, and it's quite intricate as how it all came about. But it did last quite a while.
And Kennedy, by default, picks up African-American support across the country.
He does. And quite brilliantly, his campaign, you know, the Sunday before the election, they sent out thousands of the Blue Bomb, as they called it, which was a pamphlet basically touting JFK's involvement with the Martin Luther King movement and getting him out of prison. And in doing that, they did get a lot of support. Blacks turned out in record numbers, and Kennedy won by a very, very narrow margin.
Rich's merges with Federated Department Stores in 1976. Mm-hmm. A good thing at the time?
I think it depends who you ask. I don't think it was out of line with what was going on in business at the time. You know, Dick Rich had always said he would never sell the company, and he died in 75. Not a year later, the company is basically selling themselves to Federated. There were Dick Rich's son worked there as a vice president. Some of the other people involved didn't want the company to sell. But I think on a whole, most of the people involved with Rich's thought it was a good idea. They could get more capital to expand Rich's. It was great for Federated. It gave them a leg into the southeastern United States, which they had always wanted. And I think overall, it was a fairly good fit. Rightfully so, people were concerned Rich's would change and not be what it was. And it could not have not done that. You're going from a family-controlled business to then a division, one of 19 divisions of a parent company. So it's going to change its character a bit. So I think it depends who you ask is whether or not they would agree with that.
In the 1980s, lots of financial wrangling, some bankruptcies, some hostile takeovers. When all the dust settles, eventually Rich's merges with Macy's.
Yes.
And takes on the Macy's name. Do you think Rich's in any way has affected Macy's? Or has it just been absorbed and Macy's is Macy's?
You know, that's a tough question. I think the department store business has changed. I think retailing has changed. I think the experience of retailing is different than it was in Rich's heyday, definitely from the 20s through the 60s. So I think the whole thing is different. You know, Macy's was Federated at the time, and Federated merged. They bought Macy's out of bankruptcy, basically, and then decided to merge the two companies, which made sense from a business perspective. You've got Macy's and Rich's in the same market, operating stores in the same mall. You know, sadly for Rich's, it was pretty inevitable that the local chain would go in lieu of the national chain, which I alluded to in the book by saying, you know, that Macy's had this national reputation because of Miracle on 34th Street and all these things. That's a tough question. I think some people would say or like to think that Rich's had an effect on Federated from 76 to the merger until the name change, which was been in 2003. But it's a hodgepodge of so many different things going on at the time. The whole retail industry completely changed, and there were so many mergers in those, you know, in the early 2000s. It's hard to say. And Federated, when it started, and I believe it was 29, had some incredible stores that had great philosophies as well. So I would like to think that, yes, Rich's affected Federated, which then changed their name in 2007 to Macy's. But
Rich's has always been much more than a store. Its role in shaping this city has been profound. I mean, Coca-Cola we all know about, but Rich's, the Rich Foundation, gifts to Emory, Georgia Tech, Georgia Baptist Hospital, now Atlanta Medical Center, the United Negro College Fund, and even a radio station. Isn't that strange?
It's very strange and very wonderful. And actually, the very radio station that we're broadcasting from. Yes, Rich's in 1948 gave, through the Rich Foundation, WABE, to the city of Atlanta as a gift. And I'm sure many listeners know W is the call letter east of the Mississippi River, and ABE stands for Atlanta Board of Education. So it was an interesting gift and quite remarkable what they did. Not only did they give the radio station, they made sure that all the schools in Fulton County had receiver sets. They would do educational programming from WABE. And they'd actually done it before they gave this station. They did it through other stations they did it through Rich's, actually, who had their own radio station. In order to gift it to the city, they gave it as a gift, or it gets complicated business-wise. But it's remarkable. They taught all these school children, and you talk to people that remember the programs coming through the radio receiver sets in their classrooms. And it's amazing to me that we're sitting here now in something that was basically started through a generosity of Rich's.
If you had to sum up the reason or reasons for Rich's success, my gosh, from 1867, well over a century as a family-owned store, cherished in Atlanta, the sit-in movement notwithstanding,
right.
How would you sum it up?
Again, that's a hard question. It depends, you know, and doing the research for this book, I would mention Rich's and people's eyes glaze over. And, you know, you have these 65-year-old men that become 6-year-old kids again. I mean, it was truly phenomenal, people's reactions to this store. And even after Federated in 1976, you still had 30-odd years that Rich's expanded, and tremendously. They were 29 department stores, you know, and 19 bake shops, and then you have the whole Richway chain. So even with Federated, they expanded, you know, leaps and bounds, and people that only knew Rich's after Federated still have this unbelievable nostalgic memory of Rich's. It's hard. I think Morris Rich was onto something when he started the store. You know, he came to the devastated South. Atlanta was in the throes of the Reconstruction era. And he decided to treat people, I guess, with dignity in a way, and sort of made the store his home, made their home. And I think that transcended, you know, and if Rich is the joke, and not really a joke because it was the truth, was they would take back anything. And, you know, this philosophy of what can we do? What can we do to make it right? How can we make the customer happy? You don't see that much anymore.
Jeff Clements is the author of Rich's, a Southern Institution. Jeff, thanks for taking the time.
Thank you.
Fascinating book.
Thank you very much.